Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com. Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katema, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. I hope everyone is safe and well and staying in good spirits despite whatever is going on right now. And our studio is currently closed due to the outbreak of COVID-19 in New York City. So we are recording this episode remotely from my apartment in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And this show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Chris Ori, who is a whiskey expert based in California. And Japanese whiskey is very popular among whiskey connoisseurs in the world lately. Chris understands Japanese whiskey thoroughly, but it's not the only reason that he's here today. He has done something very precious for the shochu industry of Japan. For listeners who are not familiar with shochu, it is a Japanese traditional distilled spirit made from grains and vegetables such as sweet potato, barley, rice, buckwheat, and sugarcane. And in Japan, if shochu is barrel-aged for a long time and its color turns amber, you cannot sell it in the market. It doesn't make sense, but that is how it works and the law. So about 10 years ago, I met a woman who was the owner of a shochu distillery in Japan. And she recently contacted me and said that an American gentleman bought their unsaleable barrel-aged shochu and made it into coveted whiskey label in the U.S. So I was so intrigued by the story and asked her to introduce me to that gentleman. So here he is. That is Chris Ori. So today we'll discuss the unique flavor profile of barrel-aged shochu, the Japanese regulation to restrict the sales of dark-colored shochu, how dark-colored shochu can be sold in the U.S. as whiskey, and much, much more. But quickly before you start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanese@theheritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Now let's start a conversation with Chris Ori. Hello, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So did I pronounce your last name properly? U-R-D-O-D.
Udi is one way you can say Uda, Udi, or we say Yudi as well. There's a million ways.
Okay, I got it so wrong. Sorry. All right. So, first of all, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
Well, I'm from Athens, Georgia originally, and my diet growing up was a little bit mixed depending on what age I was. When I was real little, my mom raised three of us by herself as a teacher, and so we ate a lot of baked chicken. On Sunday, it was baked chicken, and then Monday would be baked chicken sandwiches, and on Tuesday, it would be baked chicken and soup. Then as I got older, got a job, it became lots of soul food where I would splurge, and then, of course, a lot of fast food as well.
Okay. Sounds like you had a very good diet when you grew up.
I definitely got my calories in one way or another.
Right. All right. So so you're known as a whiskey expert, and LA Magazine called you the first name in LA whiskey. So how did you get into the beverage business?
Well, it was a little bit serendipitous, to be honest. I I'm originally from Athens, and I played in rock and roll bands there, and I decided I couldn't stay there anymore because I was starting to become Peter Pan and Never Neverland, so I needed to get out, and I had a place to stay in New York, and I had a place to stay in L.A., and I'd been in New York before because of rock and roll. We used to go there and play, but in L.A., I'd never seen it, so I traveled out to L.A. to meet with a friend of mine whose couch I would be staying on and just kind of catch up with him. And he worked at a liquor store, and it turned out he couldn't get off work that day. So I stayed with him at the liquor store and put a bunch of cases away and was just catching up on old times when these guys came in to sell him high-end single malt, single cask Scotch whiskey. And because I was friends with him, they let me try it as well. And it really kind of opened my eyes to what whiskey is. It was incredible. I'd never really tried anything like it. I'd always been a typical Southern boy with lots of volume drinking, PBR and bourbon. Anyway, at the end of the day, the liquor store owner saw me move so many cases, he offered me a job. And the guys that came in to sell him whiskey, because I asked them so many questions, they offered me a job as well. So now I had two job offers and a couch. So I moved to LA, and that's how I ended up in the beverage business. It was completely bad.
Wow. Well, the luck, two lucks, I guess. Wow. So what's your job as a whiskey expert?
So it's changed over the years. I guess officially I've got two jobs. I run the Southern California operations for a distributorship, and then I'm co-owner in an import company that brings whiskeys from other countries into the U.S. But our job, because we're a small company and because we deal with smaller family-owned brands, our job is more of making sure that we educate the consumer as far as their investment that they're making into our products. So that's where I come in as a whiskey expert, is to make sure everyone's empowered to be able to make the decision that they want, so they're taking home a bottle that they're going to love.
Right. Well, the whiskey market has been really hot, and everybody wants to have good whiskey. So probably you don't have to try to sell more. Like you said, you have to educate people. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, it's a little of both, right? You're always nothing. No business is done without a sale. But we definitely focus on the educational side of it, because why choose one whiskey over another? Like when you're making, it's not a small investment when you invest in a bottle of whiskey, anywhere from, you know, on the cheaper end, it could be $30, but on the higher end, it could be hundreds of dollars. We just want to make sure that people that buy our whiskeys know what they're getting and that they're happy with what they're getting, so that there's no disappointment. Because that's a lot of people work very hard for their money nowadays, and they want to be able to whiskey something that they want to be able to enjoy at the end of it. And we want to make sure that they've got the right one for them, because there is no whiskey.
Yeah, I happened to go to the Whiskey Fest, and the last one in New York City. There are like hundreds, and it's not just the same colored thing. It's so many different aging to production method to ingredients, and I was confused, to be honest. So yeah, I understand you need education. So let's talk about the Japanese whiskey that you discovered and made into a wonderful Japanese shochu made it into wonderful whiskey. So it's called the Fukano Distillery Whiskey, and it scored number 20 in the top 20 of 2017 by Whiskey Advocate, and it was the only Japanese whiskey in the category. So it is a big deal. So what exactly is the Fukano Distillery Whiskey, and how it's made, and what flavor profile does it have? And you can just explain whatever it is.
Oh, wow. So to do that, I kind of want to take you a little bit into the history of distilling in Japan, and it's going to make more sense when I come out at the end. So if we look at the history of whiskey, the first written whiskey is in 1494 in Scotland, where the friar John Corr was ordered to make 8 bowls of malt, which was about 300 liters. Meanwhile, at the same time, you had distillation kind of happening in East Asia as well. I mean, distillation in Japan dates back to, first written record of it is 1546, and that's actually down in Kyushu. So they think that it was heading to both regions simultaneously through different trade of commerce. Going into Asia, it was done through the Portuguese explorers, and it came in through Ryukyu first, which is now we know as Okinawa, and then it made it up into Kyushu. And it kind of makes sense that they would almost have two different words. So when people talk about shochu and whiskey, well, it makes sense that the Japanese wouldn't use the word whiskey all the way back then, because there was no commerce with Scotland. So there's no reason for that vocabulary to transfer over between the two countries. And so The south of Japan develops its own style of distillation, which involves koji and rice because they have both in plenty. And, you know, koji dates back, 9,000 years, I think, into China in clay pots. So it really does have this rich history. And they work with that type of distillation, and that's what they carry through. And because they make it from a grain, it is a whiskey, but it carries a different style of a format. In that, in Scotch whiskey, you use, or even in American whiskeys, you tend to use either column stills, which were developed in the 1800s, or you use copper pot stills, and you tend to take cuts, heads and tails, to take off the methanol to try to harvest the ethanol by itself, and you don't use koji to kind of refine the fermentation. So you end up with a more brash style of distillate that is then mellowed out by the oak. Whereas in the south of Japan, where they make shochu, they are focused on how the distillate comes off the still immediately. And because they use koji, they actually don't have any methanol in their ferment. So they don't need to take that first cut. So they start with almost a softer, more, it's almost like a softer, more elegant spirit that's designed to be drank. And then it goes into a barrel where it transitions into almost something completely different and new. And the way it ties into whiskey is that at the end of the day, like the Fukano whiskeys, they look and they taste, when they're aged in new oak casks, they look and taste like bourbons from the 1970s. It's really kind of remarkable. Or if it's a refill cask, sometimes it tastes like a grain whiskey from Scotland that's about 30 or 40 years old. If they do sherry cask, the rice distillate itself is so malleable to the type of cask that it quickly takes on the profile of the cask and transforms into almost a separate thing beyond what it started as.
Wow. That's interesting. I really never thought of connecting shochu and whiskey, and now it started to be connected in my head. That's the history of whiskey. So now, what kind of labels you have? Like Fukano Distillery whiskey, you have a couple different labels, right?
Right. So, I guess I tangented there a little bit. I apologize. I just love it so much.
I enjoy that too.
The styles are, they're made the same way, right? So Fukano whiskey is done in a single pot still. It's just a single pot still made from stainless steel. And the labels that come with that, currently we have, every year we do a limited edition. This year, the 2020 edition will be a combination of, there'll be a few wine casks in it, some refill sherry casks and some refill oak casks. And that'll be about 3,200 bottles, I think, at most. Then there's a 10-year-old, which is a combination of new oak and refill oak, and that has more of that bourbon style to it. And that's limited to a few thousand bottles as well, but there'll be three batches done of it, and then we'll see what casks Fukano-san allocates me after that. And then there'll be three single 12-year-old casks coming in this year. So every now and again, Fukano-san will allocate a cask that's just, there's no way to, all I'm going to do is, if we've added it with anything else, is take away what the uniqueness of that cask. So we decide to bottle those by themselves. And there's three of those coming in this year. And then, like, you can still find on the market some 16-year-old sherry casks and 14-year-old new oak casks, but those were sold out of those, but I think they're still floating around out there. And then there's some wine casks on the way, but those haven't been released yet.
Okay. Well, I'm a little bit, you know, like they had the barrels of shochu, and you are kind of transfer the already aged shochu to different kinds of barrels, right? Is that how it works?
Yes and no. So there's a little bit of finishing that's done where a few casks might be transferred over if we need more oak influence. But for the most part, they're kind of perfect as they are. The you know, it's a real interesting history. As you're aware, the shochu used to be able to be barrel aged in its natural cask and carry all that color with it up until the 1980s. So people were using cask to barrel age shochu and release it as that. But then there were some tax law changes, and there was some lobbying that went on, and basically as a separation of the categories, they made the law that said shochu had to be bottled at a very light color. And that's what kind of transferred shochu into not being like what we're bottling as now. So what we're bottling now is really the original product, just 30 years removed from it allowed to be used by law, if it makes sense.
Right. Okay. So do you know how many barrels in total they have? When I visited a kind of distillery, it was like I was taken to somewhere in the back, and there's some barrels and barrels. So they have plenty of shochu to be converted to whiskey, right?
They do. They, as of right now, I don't know how many casks they have on hand. Fukano-san never gives me the true number, but he's got a bunch in the distillery, and I think he keeps some offsite as well in another warehouse. So they've got plenty. Every year I go over there, and he's like, "These are the ones you can have this year."
Wow! Right, because I was looking at the website, and for example, the premium distributor Skernik, as 2019 release, they have the Vault 1, Vault 2, and 10-year and 14-year single cask. It sounds like you can discover a lot of flavors depending on, you know, the vintage. So yeah, I haven't gotten to taste any of those, but sounds really good.
Well, we'll have to fix that rapidly so that you can try them. The Vault 1s and Vault 2s are super unique because those were ones that had gone into oak back into the 90s and then were moved out of oak and actually put into tanks to stop the oak influence in the mid 2000s. And then there were different tanks, and then there were awesome oaks. So the way those were put together is we took some oak casks and we took a couple of tanks, and then we would vat that together. So it's really an expression of distillate from the 1990s all the way up until like the early 2000s for both of those in different styles. So the Vault 2 would be floral and fruity, and the Vault 1 has got this a little bit of sherry influence, a little bit of gunpowder. They're great. So we'll have to fix that. You can try them all.
Okay. I can't wait. So where is the Fukano Distillery, and what kind of history does the distillery have?
So the distillery was founded in 1823. The Fukano family was originated out of Fukuoka, and Tokiji Fukano was a rice merchant. He actually worked for the government going to source rice for the Fukuoka prefecture. And he got down to Hideyoshi and noticed how beautiful it was and decided, that's it, I'm out. He uprooted his family. They all moved down there and they opened the distillery. So in 2 years, they'll celebrate 200 years in operation, which is really fascinating.
Hideyoshi, by the way, is a shogun. So he changed the whole history of Japan.
See, that goes beyond what I know of Japan. I just know a little bit about the beverages, and as far as the politics, I'm fully removed.
Right? Yeah, but the Hideyoshi is like, wow, it's really like one of the greatest names of the history as shoguns. So, and I heard that currently they have a seventh generation. And yeah, we're going to talk about how you discovered. But you spoke to the woman that I met 10 years ago. She's the wife of the seventh generation, the sixth generation. And now Seiichi Fukano is the seventh generation who became the seventh, the president in 2015, I think. So, they have almost 200 years of history. And let's talk about how you became and came across Fukano Distillery, because it sounds like it's like a miracle.
So it was a perfect, again, that's, I guess my life runs in perfect storms. So just like I fell into the whiskey industry in LA, I fell into this as well almost. I have a friend who imported sake for a while, and he also imported shochu, and he actually imported the Fukano shochu into the US, and he had a sample of the barrel aged stuff, and I love all distillates. So we would do shows together where I would be pouring whiskey and he would be next to me pouring shochu and sake. And we did this for years. And then I had even met Fukano-san, Chizuru Fukano, Fukano-san a little bit, a few times when she had come to the US previously. And he one day brought me this sample and I thought it was incredible. And I said, "What is it?" And he goes, it's in the back of Fukano's warehouse. I was like, what are you going to do with it? He goes, "I'm not going to do anything with it." And I said, "May I have permission to take this and bottle it?" He goes, "Sure, but we can't bottle it as shochu." And I said, "I think I know how." So my wife, who's also from Kumamoto, remember it's a perfect storm, so it's got to all work out this way. So wife, Kumamoto as well. And so we go to Japan a few times a year to see her family over there. So just on one of the trips, we went to the distillery, set up a meeting, and I explained to Fukano-san, Chizuru Fukano, what I wanted to do with them. And she remembered how it used to be done back in the 70s and 80s. And she said, "That sounds like fun." And it took a little convincing for Seiichi, for the seventh generation Shacho. he wasn't quite convinced on it, but Fukano-san, his stepmom, she forced it through. I think she went to bat for us. And because I had my wife Kumiko with me as well, who could translate, who can interpret all of my American nonsense into polite Japanese, I think it kind of all came together. So it was perfect.
Right. Actually, Chizuru-san, she told me that she cried with joy when she shipped the first batch of shochu to you. And she couldn't believe that happened because it was her dream. It was going to be thrown away or something, like there's no future. And suddenly miracle happened and you saved the whole, you know, the casks. So, yeah, she was so grateful. By the way, my father is from Kumamoto and from the Hitoyoshi area. That's where the distillery is. And also that's kind of like a mecca of shochu production. One of the meccas, so Kyushu. So yeah, that's great. All right, so let's talk about the Japanese regulations that disallow colored shochu to be sold in the market. What is it about?
Well, before I go there, I wanted to take it one step back to Chizuru-san again, because what you said was very moving, because she really was I think she's one of the most brilliant women in the industry, period. And now that she's kind of retired, we're always poking her to try to get her to do something else or to get involved with something new, because she's absolutely brilliant. And it makes me very happy to hear that she was so happy when it all came in. And then the other thing with the barrels, like I know that they can, if they want, they can add new make shochu to it, or they can run them through super big heavy HEPA filters that'll pull a lot of that oak out. But I guess they didn't know what to do with them. And that's how we got lucky, which is perfect. So the way that it can be brought in as whiskey into the U.S. is pretty simple. The there's no regulations. Definitions of categories are based on trade agreements with different countries. So the only reason why we acknowledge in the U.S. we acknowledge Scotch whiskey as a distilled spirit made in Scotland, aged for a minimum of 3 years, is because of trade contracts that we have with the U.K. About the fact that we'll honor that as Scotch whiskey. Well, in Japan, there's no regulation for Japanese whiskey aside from a tax law. So there's no real definition of it. And that's been historically accurate throughout the history of whiskey distillation in Japan. So there's no trade agreement there between the United States and Japan to kind of honor. So there's also nothing to violate. So these qualify as whiskeys under the American definition of whiskey because they're distilled spirits made from grain and aged in oak casks. And so that's why we bring them in that way. It makes more sense. Like they are prohibited to be called shochu. They are not shochus. That's illegal, because shochu has to be, especially Kuma shochu, as you know, if your dad's from there, it is 28 distilleries that make some of the best shochu in the world. It has its own protected region. But to be bottled,
right, so they have like a champagne, they have a designation of the name of the region. Right.
Exactly. So, yes, exactly. Right. And they have to bottle only at a certain darkness. They're not allowed to get very dark with the distillate. It's weird how that works, that law is in place. So these don't qualify as a shochu, and we don't want to step on the Kuma shochu GI. So the only thing that they do qualify for is, once you take that away, is they do qualify as whiskeys. So we bring them in as whiskeys. And it really helps to make sense. For Americans to make sense of it, because a lot of Americans aren't even aware of the category of shochu. They have no idea that there's 28 distilleries in Kumamoto making it, and then another, I think, 125 in Kagoshima making shochu as well. It's just not, that education isn't there yet. So we hope to be the segue for people to expand the palate, expand the pie of what whiskey can be, and then they can hopefully dive into shochu from there and really get to know what those distilleries are doing. With all the different, with their locally made rice and their yeast and everything to make such beautiful distillate.
Interesting. So, by the way, the most shochu is bottled at around 25% alcohol by volume. And the one from the Fukano distillery is at the higher the proof, like as high as whiskey, like 40 to 45%.
Yeah, so again, it's all politics at the end of the day. The whiskey, by definition, is a minimum of 40% ABV. So if you were to bring it in at a lower ABV, it wouldn't, you couldn't call it whiskey at that point. It'd just be a distilled spirit specialty. Shochu in Japan is bottled at 25%, but if you go next time you go to your grocery store, you look and it's in the United States, it's usually bottled at 24%. And it'll also say soju on it, which is the Korean term for that style of distillate. And the reason why it says soju is because there is a trade agreement between, there is a thing in our tax law, in the federal tax law, that soju can come in at a reduced tax rate as long as it's no more than 24% and it has SOJU written on the bottle. So a lot of shochu producers, to avoid having to pay those taxes, will write soju on it and bring it into the States that way. So there again, it's like when you start to talk about trade between two different countries, things are modified and changed to accommodate the country they're going to.
Right. Yeah. That soju name really makes me sad. It's like, where's the national pride? And it costs a lot of money, but it's what is the nature of it, right? So
you got to get Abe-san to tell our government to include the shochu in the regulation that they gave to soju so that they can get the tax.
Yeah, I'm for it. So, but do you know why, despite the regulation, the Fukano Distillery made the barrel-aged shochu, which is going to be turning to amber. So do you know why they still did it?
Before, you know this. You tell me why they did it.
Okay, well, I just wanted to add, So I was curious. So I asked Chizuru-san why, but you're not going to be able to sell it. But she said it was right before, most of the while right before the regulation was introduced. And the reason that regulation was introduced, this is what I heard from her too. So the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher of Britain, at that time asked the Japanese government to regulate the shochu because the tax rate was much lower than that on whiskey. So that's kind of, again, just very political. And the new regulation came out. But already they made the barrels, the shochu aging barrels. So going back, why did they make that barrel aged shochu? So according to Chizuru-san, so she said that her husband saw a neighboring distillery that excess shochu and put it in wooden barrels to clear tanks for making a new batch. And her husband thought the barrel-aged shochu would be great, like unique flavors in it. And so, again, it was before the new regulation was introduced. So here they are. And you save the unusable barrels for her. So that's another story of whole, the cycle of the story.
That's very well put. So I'll give you a little bit more on the history of it. So I didn't know that about why he put the first stuff into barrel until you sent that to me in an email. So that was wonderful to read. But yes, you're absolutely right. On the history of it, Margaret Thatcher, she recognized that the shochus that were being barrel aged in bottle straight from the barrel into the bottle were a big threat to whiskey. Because if you remember, in the 1980s, whiskey was really struggling. It wasn't a category a lot of people were drinking. And there was a $6 billion trade deficit between the UK and Japan. Japan was selling $6 billion more worth of goods over there. And that's why Margaret Thatcher went over to renegotiate those import tariffs on Scotch whiskey into Japan, was to try to give it a new market that it could capitalize on. And she recognized the shochu was going to be a threat to that market. So she lobbied to get those regulations changed. Because at the time, not a lot of shochu producing families were putting stuff into casks. She caught it before it became a big thing. And so to change a law that would only affect a few families was it just kind of happened, right? Like they're the ones who suffered from it. And the reason why they had barrel access to begin with is in the 70s, Ariake Sangyo opened up a cooperage down in Miyazaki Prefecture that it was like the first time that they could really had access to high quality barrels without having to transport them from all the way from God knows where. So they had a semi-local access to it. And the reason why that cooperage went in there was to supply a company called Takara Shuzo. And Takara Shuzo is a massive, massive distillery that had like tens of thousands of casks that they were using to mature distillate in to then bottle as their chuhais. So I don't know if you remember the John Travolta commercials from Tokyo. I forget what they called it, Tokyo Highball or something like that. And And that was all Takara Shuzo. So that company came in and supplied Takara Shuzo. They immediately went around and started selling barrels to the other distilleries of Fukano and Oishi. And so, and then the regulations changed, and so all those casks were just sitting there. It was sad, but it's kind of awesome because now we get to enjoy them.
Interesting. Wow. So, yeah. So let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll discuss why Japanese whiskey is so popular right now, and much, much more. So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com. Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Aki Katayama, and my guest today is Chris Erdy, who is a whiskey specialist based in Los Angeles. And Chris has built a coveted whiskey brand out of barrel-aged shochu that was unsaleable in Japan. So let me ask you a question about the American regulation. So you're able to sell Japanese shochu under the name of whiskey in this country. So can you basically sell anything distilled with grains? Is that the simplified version of the law?
No, you can't bring in a neutral grain spirit that's distilled at 96% ABV and throw it into a cask for 5 minutes and call it a whiskey. I don't think that would go over. But the regulations for whiskey in the US are pretty loose. If you take a look at a lot of the craft distilleries, some of them will put stuff into a barrel for 5 seconds and then they'll call it a whiskey, and basically it's still new make. And that's absolutely fine. I think it's kind of great, right? Because in Scotland, you have very strict regulations on whiskeys. In Japan, it's based on a tax law only. And then in the United States, a distilled spirit made from grain and aged in an oak cask is a pretty loose definition, but there are subcategories underneath it that people do follow. So like bourbon's got a strict set of laws, and to be called bourbon, you have to follow those laws. To be called straight bourbon, you must be a minimum of 2 years. To be called straight bourbon and not put an age statement, you have to be a minimum of 4 years. So we have different subsections of the regulation. The word whiskey, I choose to view it as more of an umbrella term. So think of the word whiskey just like the word wine. You have different types of wine. You have Cabernet, you have Chardonnay, you have old world wine, new world wine. Now there's a thing called orange wines, which actually predate all of it because that dates back to the Quevry style fermentation of 8,000 years ago. But when you say the word wine, you get a fermented beverage made from grapes. And then when you use the subcategories of wine, then you start to narrow it down into exactly what you're going for. And I think whiskey's kind of the same thing. Whiskey's just a distilled spirit made from grain. But then Scotch whiskey's got to follow certain laws. Bourbon whiskey's got to follow certain laws. Canadian whiskey's got to follow certain laws, so on and so forth.
Right. So still, you created a new category of rice whiskey, right? Which I don't think existed before.
Yeah. So there's a few. I know that they're in Louisiana, they were doing one. And then in Florida, they're doing a whiskey made from rice. There's a guy in California who's done it. There's guys in Oregon who do it, and then there's some few other folks overseas as well who've dabbled in it, and we helped to kind of pioneer it. There's another company as well that brought in a whiskey made from rice as well, and they did it they went for a different flavor profile than we went for, and it's kind of two separate things, but yeah, why not, right? Why not expand the pie? Like, do you really want to eat pizza every day, or do you want to eat pizza one day, a salad the next day, and a steak another day? Like, That's right. The best part of it, ever expanding.
Right. But do you know that, you know, the difference of Afghano rice whiskey is it's made with koji, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
I'm not sure the places like, you know, Louisiana or Oregon, they use the koji to ferment it first or just straight into some kind of American style fermentation process involved. I'm just curious.
My understanding is they do not, but there is a place in the Netherlands that'll use the koji process. And yeah, the koji process is incredibly important for what you get at the end of the day. So a lot of whiskey distilleries, you'll hear some say, well, we only ferment for 36 hours. And then you'll hear other ones say, we have a very long fermentation of 60 to 72 hours. Well, the koji process that they use in Japan, that's a 21-day fermentation. It's almost an entire month long. Just to grow the koji part, the first part on the rice is 40 hours. And then you do a 7-day with the koji rice and the yeast and water added to it. And that's where you get your moromi. And then you move that to your other secondary fermentation tank where you add more of the steam rice. And that's another 14 days. So it's a very different process. But again, that's what's beautiful about it is you have an expansion of the pie. Like Scotch in Scotland, they use malted barley. That's how they get the alpha amylase, is by malting the barley. Well, in Japan, you just add the koji and you get the alpha amylase that you need. Plus, you actually start to kick the fermentation. It's great.
Right. Yeah, the koji has more kind of flavor elements because of the lot of just like hundreds of amino acids and this crazy complication within the mold itself. So, yeah, I would think it's very useful to deepen the flavors and expand the flavor profile too. But I'm always biased about koji, so.
No, it is. It gives, like, the Fukano whiskeys carry umami. They have an underlining signature that are uniquely them. Again, you know, we joke, you're knocking out bourbon, you're knocking out scotch, so make it its own. And if you look at the history of distillation in Japan, that's what they were doing back in the 1500s. So it carries that provenance of the south of Japan in that distillate that's now making its way into whiskey for the first time. And that's, we're very proud of that. Like to have a whiskey that has a rich amount of umami in it, to have a whiskey that has like a creamy texture from the koji interacting with the rice, and to have a whiskey that just has like an underlining characteristic of the rice. Because remember, they're using local rice as well. So it's all that Kumamoto rice that's absolutely so delicious that contributes that with the barrel to give you that really good end product, we think.
Right. And also the Kuma River, that's the, like, I don't know, without Kuma River, how can you make that good shochu? That's another thing of great water within the region too.
Absolutely. It's one of the three fastest flowing in all of Japan. That river is awesome.
Right. So where can we buy Fukano Distillery whiskey?
So I think it's available in about 35 states now. It's not really in any chains, mostly in mom and pop stores. So I would just suggest, like, go to your local mom and pop and see, ask them if they have it. And if they don't, they probably know how to get it, I would hope, because it's a quick online search to find us, and we're happy to supply them.
Right. Well, actually, though, I searched on the Total Wine. That's a big, you know, the chain of distributor. They carry it, one of them. So that's
awesome.
Yeah. And I heard in a Nobu restaurant in Las Vegas, I think they carry it too, for example. So it's not just the liquor shops, but the restaurants as well, probably.
So we've had really good luck with sommeliers really, really gravitating towards the idea of the rice whiskeys because of the different flavors they carry with it. A lot of the sommeliers in restaurants have been really receptive to adding it to their as part of their bar program, or the bartenders as well at the places. They, depending on who's running the program, they've been pretty receptive, because again, it's like they've got a million bourbons, but this is something truly unique. So they've been very kind to us in allowing us to have presence at a lot of really good spots. We're grateful for that.
Right. Okay, so I know there aren't so many Japanese barrel-aged shochu, but what is special about barrel-aged shochu compared to regular whiskey or regular shochu?
So I think it carries the provenance of Japan. Like, you, shochu, regular whiskey is designed as a, as almost a means to an end in most cases. That's starting to change now with different craft distillers and different big players as well starting to experiment with locally grown barleys and native yeast strands and whatnot. But historically, it was just a means to harvest as much ethanol as possible and then stick that ethanol into a cask and let that cask mellow it out to give you at the end of the day was what whiskey is. Whereas on the shochu side, they're more focused on the first drops coming off of the still because most of the shochu that's consumed is either rested for a minimum amount of time or consumed fresh. So they focus a lot on making sure they get the highest quality distillate they possibly can. Like some distilleries will even use a reduced pressure still so that they can lower the vaporization point of the ethanol and get more of a floral, softer spirit without having a lot of bite behind it. And I think that's one of the fundamental differences is like, let's say with bourbon, if you take new make bourbon, it's a pretty feisty beast. And when you put it into a new charred oak cask, which is also a feisty beast, they fight each other for years. And at the end of it comes this beautiful distillate. Well, on this side, you start off with a really beautiful distillate, and then you start to manipulate it with the type of oak you put it into. So if you use, let's say, Sakura cask, which are now starting to become available in the south of Japan, where the Sakura trees are grown in Kumamoto, and it influences with the distillate, you get this thing that's truly unique, and that is of the south of Japan, I think. Mm. So
interesting. I've never heard.
Distillates.
Yeah, the cherry casks. Mm. Right? Wow. Amazing. Because like, you know, the cherry flowers are very visible, but if you smell the leaves, they have very distinctive notes. So I would imagine casks may be very unique.
That's kind of funny, right? Because as a whiskey expert, I'm supposed to be able to explain people what they should get from casks. And in most casks, it's very easy. You can say an Oloroso cask, you say dark dried fruits, figs, dates, unsmoked pipe tobacco. A Mizunara cask, you can always say sandalwood. But when it comes with a Sakura cask, you just have to say it's like a Sakura cask. And I've yet to find the good descriptors that you can describe what Sakura cask tastes like to someone who doesn't know what it is. You almost have to say, here, try it. And then when they try it, they go, oh yeah, Sakura cask.
Right. It's like, well, how does lemon taste like? It's just lemon. It's kind of the same uniqueness, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Even then you can say yuzu with a little bit more acidity to it, right? And then you can kind of describe lemon, but Sakura cask is just its own
wow.
thing.
Interesting. Wow, look into it because it sounds very interesting. And maybe it could be a future of cooperage in Japan. Like Mizunara is so rare. And why don't you just expand the cherry casks category?
They're from what I understand, they're already working on it. They've got cherry, like the Ariake Sangyo does cherry blossom casks. They'll do Mizunara casks. They'll do a bunch of reuse casks. They'll make American oak casks over there. Oh, and that's something else I forgot to tell you is that the barrel sizes are different in Japan than they are here in the United States. In the U.S., we use 200 liter barrels and for new oak casks for bourbon. But over there in Japan, the most commonly used barrel for new oak is actually 440 liters. So they're much bigger.
Wow.
That gives us slower, you have a lot higher distillate to oak ratio, and it works out perfectly for the shochu because over here you have that feisty beast of a distillate that you need to interact with a lot of oak really quickly. Whereas over there you want it to be a little bit slow because if you let it, you can actually almost over oak some of the shochus if you're not careful with them. So
So the subtlety, that's always Japanese people's preference, I think. Yeah, I understand you also sell some Japanese, great Japanese whiskey labels. So that's original definition of whiskey, like made for being whiskey. This whole thing that we've been talking about, the aged shochu turned to be whiskey, but Japanese whiskey has been very popular. So why is that? What is the difference between other whiskeys and Japanese whiskey?
Well, that can be traced to two specific events in history, actually, why all of a sudden Japanese whiskey got to be popular. It's I know it's hard to imagine now, but it, you know, 6-7 years ago, you used to be able to buy any Japanese whiskey you wanted at a severely discounted price, and none of them were really worth anything whatsoever. And what happened was in 2013, there's a publication called The Whiskey Bible. And that year, Jim Murray, who writes that book, gave Yamazaki Single Sherry Cask Whiskey of the Year above everything. And that woke the Western world up to what Japanese whiskey was. To really put that in perspective, a couple of months before that book came out, I was in Kumamoto buying Yamazaki Single Sherry Cask bottles for $70 US. And I could have as many as I wanted. They weren't allocated. You could get them anywhere. After the book came out, it took just a few weeks. And then all of a sudden you couldn't get it anywhere. And then in a few months when you could get it, it was $1,300 a bottle. That same, yeah. And that was 2013. Then in 2014, we had the exact same thing happen in Japan, except in a different way, where there was a television drama called Masa about Takatsuda-san, who was the founder of Nika. And that came out, it was a limited series that came out in Japan, and it woke all the Japanese people up to wanting to try their own domestically made whiskey. So then you had a whole bunch of people in Western culture wanting to drink Japanese whiskey, as well as a whole bunch of Japanese people wanting to drink Japanese whiskey. And it simply just decimated the aged stocks. And none of the distilleries were prepared for that type of increase in demand. And so it created this perfect storm of people wanted it. They heard great things about it, but they couldn't get it. And then people who did get it were saying great things about it because it was great. And then it just made people want it more. So then it became more expensive. And then people said, well, clearly, if it's more expensive than it was last year, it must be that good. So now I want it even more. And it just snowballed into this craziness. And luckily, we've all been lucky in that the brands that have stepped in to fill the void, and even the big guys that those two stories were about, what they've continued to release has all been of really high quality. So it's helped to perpetuate the attractiveness of the category. So like, now you have distilleries in Japan that might not have been in the US 6 and 7 years ago. They're here now, and they're putting out really good stuff. And so it's just helping to keep the motor running for people to be excited about it. And I also think that as people are shifting what they are wanting to have, like with the opportunity to be able to research things in a second, and now that everyone's got it at the tip of their fingers, even they had it 6 years ago, but even more so now. Everybody wants variety. So they want to drink bourbon one day, and then maybe they want to drink scotch another day, and then maybe they want to drink something from Japan the third day. And it's structured different, so it's kind of nice. So it fits right into what we're all doing already. So we're all on board, and everything's just crazy go nuts. It's perfect.
Right. Yeah, you can recognize so many different new labels from Japan, Japanese whiskey, like Ichiro to just, it's so even hard to follow how many new products are coming out. And whereas I actually asked, the chief blender of Suntory, Fukuyo-san, he came onto the show too. And he said, you can't boost the production because it takes like 10, 20 years to make whiskey, and you never know how popular the brand stays as strong as now. So yeah, it's a very long-term market, and that's why it's kind of quality oriented, right? Because it's such a big investment. And I really think whiskey industry is really fascinating because it's kind of deliberate, and it's not like a beer production. It really takes a long time. You have to be patient financially and mentally. So
that's right. If you want to do it right, it takes a long time, or it definitely takes significant investment. You can always, I don't think anyone that tries to cut corners will survive. So luckily for the most part in the category, everyone's been very, very cautious about what they put out to make sure that they put their best foot forward, which is great.
Right. So do you see any other barrel-aged shochu around in the market right now?
Yeah, so we actually imported another one called the Oishi Distillery, and they're friends with Fukano Distillery. They're about 25 miles away, and Oisan is sixth generation master distiller. And there's always it's fun because we all get together to have lunch when I'm in Kumamoto, and they always go back and forth as to who was the first to put one in the cask, because they think they can't remember exactly who was, but Oi-san thinks Fukano-san was the first by exactly 1 week to put stuff in a cask.
That's funny. Yeah, they're very close to each other, right? It's like a huge close-knit community too.
They are, and it's great because they're very supportive of one another. So when we go to do our business meetings, I have a 3-year-old named Kaito, and I'll call Fukano-san and ask him if he's available for a meeting, and his reply isn't yes. When do you want? His reply is Kaito coming?
Before you. Right. Well, that's cute. Yeah. By the way, for listeners who are interested in visiting Hitoyoshi area, it's beautiful. Again, the Kuma River is stunning, and you can take a long, nice train to watch the whole flow of the river, and you can visit. I think it's open to the public, right? You can visit some of the distilleries.
You can. They won't let you have access to the barrel-aged stuff because of the regulations. They'll just pour you their shochus, which is really good on its own. And if you get to Hideyoshi, there's a lot of things to do. You've got Aoi Aso Shrine, which is a shrine that dates back 1,200 years. And then you've got to make sure that you eat unagi when you're there. So they're known for their eel. And then go visit. There's 28 distilleries in that region that you can go hit, and they all do some really fascinating things. And there's a couple of hot springs as well. It's really quite a nice place.
Right. I don't know if they're still going, but when I visited there, there is what's called the Shochu University, and that's like a monthly meeting of all those producers. And one night, I just happened to be there that night, once a month evening. And there's so many good shochus around, and they're having good time. And I really think it's such a precious, very special cultural destination too.
Yeah, I've never had the privilege of going to one of those meetings, but I imagine it was a lot of fun because I love drinking shochu.
Yeah. All right. So what are your plans?
Our plans are pretty simple. So in our company, we do the more traditional style Japanese whiskeys. We do the rice whiskeys from the south of Japan. We do Scotch whiskeys, Belgian whiskey, Welsh whiskey. So our plans are pretty cut and dry. As a small company, we just try to find really good distillate and bring that in for people to enjoy. And we hope that people enjoy it. So it's like, that's what's so great about the rice whiskeys is that it's kind of a new world and they're incredible. And so we're really excited to have those with us, but we're also very excited to have Welsh single malt whiskey made in a Faraday still, which is a completely different, unique beast that we bring in. And is really cool, or like a Belgian single malt whiskey that's made from a triple ale. All of those things we think are contributing to the category of whiskey as a whole. And so we want to bring, and our plan is to continue that. Maybe we do some rums, maybe we do some agave, who knows, but as it stands, like just really bringing good distillate in so people can enjoy it is the only plan.
Right. So keep pushing the envelope of whiskey. And beyond, probably. Yeah, so, well, thank you for joining us today, Chris.
Thank you very much for having me, Akiko.
So please keep me posted on whatever you're working on, and hopefully you can come back.
Thank you very much. Everyone have a great day.
Okay, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatayama.com. Japan Needs is always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week. Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.